And today I'll continue the series of talks on the asava. The asava, the defilements which cause the mind to ferment, to become sour, to go bad. Today's topic is on the parivacchana pahatapa asava. The asava, or the method of removing the asava, which consists of avoiding. Doing away with the asava through avoiding, getting rid of them, removing them simply by avoiding. Now this is important to be clear about this one. It's a subject which is very easy to misunderstand. And indeed, Buddhism is often very much misunderstood as being a religion which consists of avoiding things like responsibility or involvement or which involves running away from reality, running away from suffering, running away from problems. And so it's important to clear this up first of all. I think it's fair to say that Buddhism does to some extent advocate running away or avoiding or keeping out of what is generally called modern society or public society. But I think this is a fair statement because I think modern society or public society is something which is very much misunderstood, and there's a great bias in our understanding of society, or what we call society. And we think of society as the right and the proper way to organize groups of people. And we base this on Aristotle or on Socrates, on Plato and so on. On these ancient philosophers who we assume were infallible and who we assume are being followed to the letter. And yet we see that the aims and the goals and the fruits which come from these systems which we call society tend very much on the side of greed and on the side of lust, tend very much on the side of consumerism in the sense of seeking out for things which are impermanent, things which are unsatisfying, and things which are not under our control, seeking out for things which are subject to dissolution, which are ephemeral. And so what we find is that when we reach out and want more and more and more, there are other beings who also reach out and want more and more and more. And eventually there's not enough for anyone because our wants are far greater than our actual needs. And so we create what we call society. And this is of course very much simplified, but it's clear in my mind that there's a great element of truth in this. And it's based on the Lord Buddha's idea of explanation of how society arose and so on. People were not satisfied simply by collecting wild roots and fruits and wild edibles, which at that time would have been plentiful, at the time when people lived in the forest and among the trees. But nowadays we see that We see simply from the words where people say going off to live in the forest is a kind of running away. We see how far we've come from the nature which is our home, which is our true home. And now we think of trees as something like an ornament that you put on your front lawn. We think of peace and quiet is something you find when you close your door or when you lie down to sleep in your cement room, like a jail cell. And this is because of the being unsatisfied, the lack of contentment, being discontent with what we have. When we have little, we're not able to live. And of course, Socrates himself was very clear on this fact. When he sat down and started to create, his idea of society was that we would eat things like acorns and drink spring water and so on, eat foods which were raw and which were bland and so on, simple foods which could be easily found from foraging and so on. But we can see that the lack of contentment, and Socrates pointed this out, and it was clear that no one was going to go for such a society. And so then we have to start collecting food. And when we collect food and keep food for the next day and the next day and the next day, when we keep it more and more and more, well, we have to expand our range. And when our range interferes with other people's range, well, we have to set up fences. We have to set up territories. And setting up territories, then we find that our territory is not big enough to satisfy our desires, or our desires become manifold, and so we have to alter the territory. We have to cut down the trees and start specializing in a certain type of food. And we specialize in something and maybe begin to barter or to trade or so on and so on. And eventually we have what is now this big mess which we call society. And it has to do with a great population explosion. Of course, population explosion, we all know where that comes from. It comes from something which is considered nowadays to be natural, and this is the sexual intercourse, something which probably wouldn't have been a big problem if we could keep our minds and our hearts and our eyes and our bodies under control. But we can see how out of control it becomes and how our population explodes. And because, of course, of our keen intellect and our ability to get what we want most of the time, we've come to take over most parts of this earth and radically alter the face of it. We can see how someone who is able to control their bodies and not the body and not interested in running after objects of the sense is able to live in great peace and harmony in a very ancient way. And so I think in this sense some of the criticisms are very much biased, and of course rightly so. They come from people who are very much engrossed, involved, very much enchanted by society, and get involved in political debates and so on, and create all sorts of systems and organizations. But we find there are still people in this world who refuse to be involved, refuse to indulge in the foolish running after, chasing after things which are not truly going to satisfy. And we can see this is, when it comes down to it, this is the main goal of society, is to get all the time what we want, as much as possible. And of course we try not to interfere with other people while doing so. But of course the main problem is the wanting. And wanting is something which easily gets out of control. When we're free from wanting this or wanting that, then we don't have to fight or argue or interfere with other people's business. And so we're able to live in a very natural way. And so the argument is that living in the forest is certainly not running away. It's coming back to a natural, a very normal state of existence. And another important point, which I think is less of a criticism, but more of a problem for meditators, for people who take up the Buddhist path, and this is running away from suffering. I have heard it as a criticism that, or as a reason why many people have taken up the Buddhist path. Some people from outside have said it's because they've had suffering thrown at them for so long that they just want to find a way out of it. They want to run away from it. They don't want to face it anymore. And so they take up Buddhism, which advocates, so they say, running away from suffering. And Buddhism, of course, does no such thing. Buddhism is for the realization of suffering. It's the first noble truth. It's for the understanding of suffering and why we suffer. And we don't ever have to run away from suffering. What we have to do away with is the cause of suffering. And we have to understand what it really is, suffering. And so we understand that suffering is not just simply a painful feeling. It is the attachment to the painful feeling, which comes from craving, which comes from clinging, wanting it to be this way, wanting it to be that way, of course, when it's not the way we want. This is when suffering arises. But for a person who practices the Buddhist path, as we can all see when we practice meditation, we actually have to face suffering in a way that an ordinary person never would dare to, never would be able to. When we sit down and close our eyes, and the pain comes up, and rather than running away or shifting our position, we come closer to it. We come to see clearer about it. We come to focus on it. And by focusing and keeping our mind clear, saying to ourselves, pain, pain, as a simple reminder that this is only pain, creating a clear thought, which replaces the thoughts of disliking, the thoughts of upset, to the point where the painful feeling is seen clearly for what it is, comes to register in our minds and in our memories as something which is neutral. And because of our lack of clinging and our lack of craving in regards to the pain, there arises no suffering next time or the next time or the next time. We find ourselves free from the suffering which would arise from the pain or from the uncomfortable situation. So it's completely due to lack of understanding, due to lack of thorough investigation of the Buddha's teaching, that people would say that Buddhists run away from suffering. It's got some element of truth to it, but when using this as a criticism, they think of suffering as things like pain or things like uncomfortable situations, which of course are very much a part of the Buddhist path. And people would continue this by saying, by closing our eyes, by going into our room, by taking a retreat. They say, you close your eyes, you can't see anything. Or you run away, it's easy to practice when you're running away in your room and not confronting anyone. So how is it that you are confronting uncomfortable situations if you're always running away and doing what they call retreats? And there's an element of truth to this. It's true that when you close your eyes, you don't see everything. But it's also true that sometimes when you see too much, you go blind. When you see too much, you can't see anything. And we know this very well from looking at very powerful light sources. When we look at the sun, we can go blind. When someone shines a bright light in your face, you go blind. When I used to go out of my house in the winter into the snow, 6 feet deep snow, I had to jump out the second floor window. You can go blind briefly. You have to close your eyes and slowly open your eyes because of the blinding light reflecting from the ice crystals. And so in the same way, not exactly the same, this isn't the physical light which we're talking about now, but when we open our eyes, we see too much. Sure, if we could be truly mindful with our eyes open, there'd be no reason to close our eyes. But when we close our eyes, an ordinary person who hasn't practiced is able to focus their mind and fix their mind on one object. If our concentration is not strong and our eyes are open, we'll easily flit from one thing to another and not be able to see clearly about anything. People have accused Buddhists of being obtuse. Closing our eyes, how can we see the truth? Well, the problem is we're like infants, we're like children. So we close our eyes, and yes, we go off into our room at first. We do this as a practice, as a means of training. We say as a training, like training wheels. And you can't blame the child for using training wheels. He knows that if he didn't use them, he would fall off the bike. So what we do here is simply a training for our lives. It's not running away. It's easing off or making it easier for us in the beginning. And when we practice and practice, when we're truly strong enough to deal with the things around us, then we can open our eyes and we can walk around. And of course, meditators do this and eventually do leave the centers. But usually in the end, they end coming back because they realize that out there there's just a whole bunch of people excited and intoxicated by things which are only a source for more and more suffering. They see that there's society has come to take, what we call society, has come to take over most of the world. And there's very little of the world which lives in a wholesome, in a peaceful, in a natural way in this day and age. We try to find places to create our own society, a society which is based on contentment, which is based on renunciation, giving up, letting go. So this all is sort of a precursor to the actual teaching here. The things which the Lord Buddha said, and it's very interesting to consider, the things which the Lord Buddha said are necessary to avoid. And the first one is things like elephants or snakes or wild animals, any sort of thorn bush or something, or like a deep pit or a deep river or so on. Like when you're walking and you come across a bramble bush, well, you go around it, or you're walking through the forest and you come to a place with thistles or something, you have to go around it. Or you come across a wild elephant, well, you don't just keep walking and say, if I die, I die. You go around it. Why? You would lose a great amount of benefit. You would be doing something which was, when you had the choice, you'd be doing something which is unwise. You would choose to do something to destroy your practice, to destroy your ability to practice. Something which would possibly lead to your great injury or death. And of course, not out of fear of death, this is important, but out of a understanding of what is right and wrong. When you have the choice, you do what is the appropriate thing, what wise people would appreciate or would laud, would say is a good thing to do. The first thing is things like wild animals, and this can also mean places which have wild animals. Now, of course, the forest has certain wild animals, and this can be a danger. You can't go to a place to practice where there are wild tigers or lions roaming about. It wouldn't be wise, it wouldn't be a conducive place. And it would lead possibly to more and more defilement to arise in the mind. You'd be sitting in meditation and always afraid or worried or always distracted. by the prospect of being confronted by a wild animal or by something which could cause great problems. And of course, mosquitoes don't fall into this category. We can't consider mosquitoes to be wild animals. Some things like animals which bite and so on are to be considered things which we have to be patient, and as I talked about last time. And by the same token, talking about mosquitoes, we do have to be careful about things like malaria. We can't simply sit and let ourselves be bitten and bitten again when we know there might be a potential risk of malaria which would compromise our practice and compromise our ability to see clearly and to finish the practice. But this is the first part. The second part has to do with places and people which are unsuitable. For instance, places like bars or places of entertainment, of merriment, carnivals and festivals, places where the recreation, the activities which are going on, which are occurring, are involved with unwholesomeness. Avoiding brothels, avoiding bars, avoiding drug fests or places where opium dens and so on. Nowadays it means avoiding what we call parties. Avoiding these things as a practice. No, this is not something which everyone has to do. If someone, an ordinary person, enjoys those things and likes those things, then they will of course go and do those things. But this is a very objective thing. If a person wishes to be free from mental defilement, wishes for their mind to be pure, then there is a certain necessity to do away with these things. So it's possible that by going into a pub one can stay without creating unwholesomeness, without oneself becoming intoxicated or taking intoxicating drink. But it is equally possible that by going in we might fall risk to temptation, and we would be subject to a bad reputation, subject to reprimand, subject to being looked down upon by people who know better. And when people see us attending wild parties and going to bars and so on, then they start to lose their interest in taking us as their friend. Those people who are interested in spirituality, interested in peace and so on, they aren't able to stay with us, and we aren't able to stay with them, and we find ourselves being surrounded by people who are engaged in unwholesome, unprofitable things. And this is the other part, is the part about people which are inappropriate. Of course, it's inappropriate for someone who wants to be free from mental defilement to surround themselves with friends who are full of mental defilement and who are developing, who are on a path to develop and to increase unwholesome states. People who are engaged in unwholesome activities, engaged in things which bring about more and more craving and greed and anger and suffering and upset. And those things which create delusion and create confusion and darkness in the mind. And we have to avoid these people. This is the Lord Buddha's teaching on what we should avoid. And these things, if we didn't avoid these things, if we didn't avoid things which were a danger to us, or things which were a cause for distraction, then it would be easy for defilements to arise in our mind. And if we didn't avoid places and people which were unwholesome, places and people which were unprofitable, which brought us no benefit, which brought our minds down and led us down the wrong path and led us to greater and greater delusion and distraction and defilement, then we would clearly never become free from the asava, the things which make our minds, would become pickled. Our minds would go sour. Our minds would become defiled. Our minds would go bad. And this is a way to stop our minds from going bad and to do away with the defilement in our mind, to clean up our minds, to clear up our minds, to bring about a very true sense of clarity of mind. And this is the teaching, the Lord Buddha's teaching on parivacana pahatapa. And that's all for today.